I'm Wade Keller, editor and publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and former host here at PW Torch Livecast. If you're looking for my shows, they have moved as of July 2017. They're now called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, available through Podcast One. Enter Wade Keller on your podcast app or iTunes and subscribe to the new Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, where I cover Raw and my first show of the week, SmackDown, with my second show of the week, and then the Flagship Edition with a co-host, and we cover a broad array of pro wrestling current events, and then I end the week with a weekly interview. That's the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, now at Podcast One. Subscribe today. Just search Wade Keller.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Monday, November 20th edition of MMA Talk for Pro Wrestling Fans. I am your host, Mike Rocky, and I am joined by my two co-hosts for today's show, Robert Vallejos and Zach Haydorn. Robert, welcome to the show, and Zach, thanks for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
All right, we also would love to hear from you, so if you have a question or a comment for us, the phone number to call is 515-605-9345. Again, one more time, it's 515-605-9345. And if you want to be part of today's show, don't forget to press 1, which will tell us to bring you on live. Or if you prefer to email the show, you can do that as well. The email address is mmalivecast@gmail.com. Again, mmalivecast@gmail.com. All right, guys, let's start off with this past Saturday's Fight Night 121 event from Sydney, Australia. On paper, this wasn't a card that had me excited to see. And after covering the event live for MMA Torch, I didn't feel any differently. This was a marathon of a show to get through. And, all six fights went the distance. And aside from the Tim Means, Bilal Muhammad fight, I didn't think any of them were all that exciting. In the main event, Fabricio Werdum beat Marcin Tybura by unanimous decision, 50-45, 50-45, and 49-46. Robert, I'll start with you on this one. What were your thoughts on Werdum's performance, and what do you think lies in store for him going forward after this win?
Well, I mean, Werdum put in the kind of performance that I think we've come to expect from him. He was clearly the better fighter, clearly dominant. And as we said last week, hasn't slowed down a ton, you know, a guy that's around the age of 40. I don't know exactly where he goes because, well, he does have a legitimate claim for a title fight, as does Overeem, who's ranked ahead of him. Both those guys have recent losses to Stipe, so I don't know how much the UFC wants to throw either one of those guys right back into the title picture. I think some of the guys like the Ngannous of the world probably have a preferred seat at the top, and we also just don't know when exactly Stipe is going to return, even though the word is more optimistic that his return is going to be sooner. So I kind of see him in a bit of a purgatory where he probably is going to get a big fight in the way he got this fight, where someone else is going to have to fall out and he'll be ready to go and step in that way.
Yeah, I think last I heard too was Stipe's contract negotiations were going well. So hopefully he gets signed sooner rather than later. Zach, what did you think of his performance?
Yeah, I thought his performance was pretty dominant. I thought he went into the fight with a really solid game plan and executed that plan without much of a hiccup. I think he was the aggressor for most of it. He was able to take the little punishments that Tabura hit him with. But at the end of the five rounds, you couldn't look at that and say any other way that Werdum just was the better fighter and is the better fighter. Moving forward, I agree with Robert. You know, he's kind of in a rough spot because his recent fights, his last two, you look at him and say, okay, this guy, you know, he should be maybe in consideration for a title shot, but because he's had that and lost so recently, he's kind of in this holding pattern until the top of that division plays itself out for a little bit longer. So I kind of see him in the role that he's in right now, as Robert said, taking these fights when they come, and if something big pops or someone has to drop out for whatever reason, the UFC can slide him in. But until then, I see just him kind of in a holding pattern, at least for the early part of 2018.
Yeah, I was disappointed, actually, in Tibera's performance. You know, I expected a little bit better performance from him. You know what you're going to get with Verdum for the most part. And we have, what is it, I think UFC 218 is Ngannou and Overeem. So I would think whoever comes out of that fight will probably get the first shot at Stipe once he gets back into the fold. And then possibly, I think Verdum would have had another fight by then. And I'm sure if he wins that fight, he would probably end up getting another crack at the title, whoever wins the Stipe Overeem and Ngannou fight. So, yeah, a lot to sort out. But first, yeah, you got to get Stipe back into the fold here. So in the co-main event, Jessica Rose Clark beat Beck Rawlings by split decision, 29-28, 28-29, and 29-28. I thought the judges got this one right. I thought Clark did a much better job mixing up her offense, and I thought it was a much more well-rounded effort from her overall. So, Zach, I'm going to start with you on this one. What did you think of her performance?
Yeah, I thought it was well done. I kind of thought, like, looking at it on the surface without, like, diving into it and just watching the fight and seeing, you know, okay, who won this with the eye test, I think there was a argument to be made for Rawlings. I think she got some nice shots in, and she was able to absorb the takedowns that Clark posed pretty well. But then when you dive into it, though, and really look at it, it's clear that Clark was the winner. I think the split decision was probably the right call, and I think when I was watching it, the last round, I kind of saw that and saw the last 2.5 minutes of the last round and said, okay, wow, okay, Clark won this fight in those last 2.5 minutes outright. So I think she was the better woman, and I agree with the decision in the end.
And Robert, did you agree with the decision for Clark?
Yeah, I thought it was fine. I mean, Rawlings had her moments, and I think there was even some bias as I was kind of watching it, kind of expecting her to eventually seize the advantage. But I kind of thought Clark really did control the fights for the, you know, for the entirety of the three rounds.
Yeah, I agree. All right, next we had Bilal Muhammad getting the win over Tim Means by split decision again, 29-28, 28-29, and 29-28. I thought this fight could have gone either way. It was that close of a fight when I was actually watching it and covering it for MMAtorch.com. Robert, did you agree with the decision?
Yeah, I thought it was fine. I thought maybe Means was a little more passive than he needed to be, whereas Muhammad was more outward with his offense. And I think that's what really swung it to him. And like you said, like, this was the only fight that was really looked like a well-fought fight, where both guys really did a decent job, but I think Muhammad was the rightful victor.
Yeah, of all the fights on the main card, I thought this one was the best of the bunch. That considering they all went to distance. Zach, did you agree with the decision?
I did, and I also thought that this was the best fight on the card, kind of by far. And I did agree with the decision. I thought Muhammad worked well and was impressive against the reach that Means had, and he almost kind of beat him at his own game. I think in the end, it was very, very close and could have gone either way. But to me, Muhammad's strikes just meant a little more within the fight. I think they did more damage, and because of that, I think he deserved the win, and I think he got the win.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Zach. After the fight, in a post-fight interview, he called out Colby Covington, which I think is kind of the in-vogue thing to do. Robert, is that a fight you'd want to see?
No. I mean, I think that there's probably bigger plans for Covington, depending on if he, you know, doesn't get himself suspended or anything. I think that he's, you know, further up on the food chain. So then that fight does nothing for me.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But he had to throw Covington's name out there. So I give him credit for that. All right, guys, moving on. We had Jake Matthews defeating Bojan Vilkovic by split decision again, 29-28, 28-29, and 29-28. I thought this was another tough fight to score. And I wouldn't have actually been surprised if it had gone the other way. Either of you have anything to add in this one?
Yeah, I thought the same thing. I thought it could have definitely gone either way. And I thought, you know, overall, I thought the fight had some good moments and some good action in it, but it just didn't seem to be like distinct action. It was just kind of like it was going on and both guys were in there fighting, but none of it had any purpose behind it, I felt like. And for that reason, it kind of it dragged on for me. But from a fight standpoint, I thought it certainly could have gone both ways, but I don't disagree with the decision they gave it to Matthews.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree with your assessment of the fight as well as the whole card. Robert, what were your thoughts on it?
Pretty similar, and I'll be honest. Yeah, I'll be honest. This fight and then the opening fight with the Shane Young, I don't have good analysis of it because it was like Zach said, it was so indistinguishable that I to be frank, got bored during these fights and didn't really pay attention, for lack of a better term. So I don't have much to offer on this one or on the opening fight.
All right, moving on, guys. Elias Theodoru defeated Dan Kelly by unanimous decision, 30-28, 30-27, and 30-26. I agreed with the decision here. But this was your typical Theodoru fight. He keeps busy and outvolumes his opponents, but doesn't really inflict much damage. So I'm really not a big fan of his style or his fights. Robert, any thoughts on this one?
No, I think he kind of piled up the points. It was a little reminiscent of the Stephen Thompson performance from a couple of weeks ago. I was, you know, in my heart, I always root for Dan Kelly. I'm a fan of the guy, but he definitely looked like the 40-year-old guy fighting a much younger guy in this fight.
Yeah, for sure. And Zach, anything to add?
Yeah, I can't really add too much more to that. I thought, you know, Theodoru won handily, and Robert said about the Matthews and the Monofsky fight. I just thought it all kind of just happened, and that was about it. But I can't disagree with the decision, though.
Yeah, definitely not UFC's best card by any means. So in the opener, we had Alexander Volkanovsky getting the string of decisions started with a unanimous decision over Shane Young. This fight was pretty one-sided, with Young having no answers for Volkanovski's takedowns. And considering neither of you have much to add on this one, let's just move into this Saturday's UFC Shanghai card, which is headlined by Michael Bisping versus Kelvin Gastelum. And aside from the main event, this is probably another one of the UFC's weaker cards, probably a little bit even weaker than the one we just reviewed. And then add the very early start time, and you probably have an event that will most likely be viewed only by the most hardcore of hardcore fans and gamblers. So if it's okay with both of you, you want to just stick with previewing the main event on this?
That sounds good to me.
All right, good. All right, so we have Michael Bisping. He faces Kelvin Gastelum after losing his middleweight title to George St. Pierre 3 weeks ago. You know, we ran a roundtable on MMATorch.com asking if you agreed with the UFC booking Bisping in this fight. And it was almost unanimous in everyone thinking it was a bad decision. And Zach, your weekly column was about this fight and how against it you are. So I'm going to start with you. How do you see Bisping's performance going, and who do you think wins this one?
Was very critical about this in the most recent column on MMA Torch. And I mainly it just stems from the place of, in my mind, Michael Bisping just doesn't seem like a guy, based on the things that he's saying and how he's kind of acting, that he's in a mental place to take this fight. And to me, instead of preying on that and using it, the UFC should be protecting him more. And for that reason, I don't think Bisping is going to be in a good enough place mentally or physically to win this fight. I think that Gastelum is just going to wear him out in the end, and I think he'll kind of have to hold Bisping off for the first couple rounds, and then after that, I think he's going to be able to pounce and just wear him down throughout the entirety of the fight. Bisping's the bigger guy. I think he's the more powerful guy in the end, but I just think he's not in a place from a mental standpoint or a physical standpoint that leads me to believe he can come out and win this thing. So for that one, I'm going with Gastelum, and wish we didn't have to see it.
Yeah, and for any listeners who haven't read Zach's take, I recommend going to MMATorch.com and seeking it out. It's definitely worth the read. Robert, how do you assess Bisping and his what you expect out of him coming Saturday?
Well, I agree with most of Zach's sentiments that this is just a really bad look for the UFC. And if something serious happens to Bisping, I mean, you know, who knows what the consequences, if any, of that could potentially be. With that said, and I said it last week, I'm kind of leaning Bisping just because I have so little faith in Gastelum as a middleweight. And I think that in the fight against GSP, I thought that Bisping looked very large. It might be because he was fighting another natural welterweight in GSP. So I think the size advantage is going to come into play, and I think Bisping gets the win here. But I'm not super sold on it, and I could definitely be swayed by the end of the week.
Yeah, I'm not really sure which way to go on this one. You know, my first reaction was Gastelum for sure. But like you mentioned, Robert, I'm not sold on Gastelum in this weight division. He's kind of like one of those in-betweeners. So, yeah, I'll probably have to do a little bit more research on it before I come up with a decisive prediction on this one. But if I had to pick right now, I would probably go with Gastelum. So, all right, guys, before we break for commercial, we do have a caller on hold. So let's go to him or her now. 814, you are on. Please state your name and the city you're calling from.
Brian from Cumberland, Maryland. Heavy question on Michael Bisping for you. Dave Meltzer reported a few weeks ago that he had some sort of eye injury or was having vision issues, but do you know exactly what's wrong with his eyesight?
Zach or Robert, either you want to take that one? I'm not quite sure.
I think he's virtually like blind in one eye. Well, I mean, he could see out of it, but it doesn't sit well, and the socket of it is like really messed up. And it's one of the things he has said that he doesn't want. If he were to fix it now, it would essentially end his career. So he's going to wait till his career is over to fix it. I know that the way that GSP got the angle on him in their fight, the kind of the subtext and read between the lines of what GSP said, they knew they could get him on that side because the defense wouldn't be as good on that side. So it actually seems like it's a fairly serious injury.
Yeah. So you'd almost think that Gastelum would probably have that same game plan, you would think, especially having film on what GSP did. So that should be interesting to see how that plays out. Ryan, anything else for us?
Yeah, I have a question sort of about what Conor McGregor did few weeks ago, jumping the fence. Is there a policy with the fighters appearing on other promotion shows? It's like a UFC fighter going into a Bellator show and just say, like, not doing something that extreme, but just say, like, supporting one of their friends or, like, teammates in their camps? Or do they have to try to stay off camera when they appear on these events?
I can't speak for sure to whether or not there's an actual written policy, whether it be Bellator or the UFC. Zach or Robert, you might have a little bit of information on that than I do. But that being said, I'm sure the UFC wasn't happy about Conor McGregor jumping into a Bellator cage. I think that's pretty safe to say. So, Robert, are you aware of any actual policy as far as, you know, speaking to Ryan's question?
Yeah, I don't think there would be, because we see so many examples of, you know, the Diaz brothers, they'll be, you know, frequently appearing at Bellator broadcasts when they do shows in California, and they have, you know, they haven't faced disciplinary action for that. And conversely, I've seen when Benson Henderson has been on a few UFC cards cornering guys, you know, while he's an active fighter with Bellator. I don't think that there's anything in there. I'm sure, you know, there's obviously some legal language that could get that enforced. But these guys are independent contractors, so that would be kind of difficult to do that. And it's a little bit different than, say, like WWE, where remember the Highlander back in the day got fired because he was seen on camera at a TNA event? I think it's a little bit different with the entertainment and a television company. Right. So I don't think that that's quite an enforceable thing, but I don't know. We're not privy to UFC contracts. You know, they're not public knowledge, so I wouldn't be able to tell you definitively.
Yeah, and I can't say definitively either, but, you know, I was thinking along the same lines you were, as far as them being independent contractors, and I find it difficult for them to be able to enforce such a policy. Zach, anything to add, or are you in agreement?
Yeah, I'm definitely in agreement, and I think even if at this point in time anyway, even if there was some sort of rule, Conor McGregor thinks he can do whatever he wants anyway, so it certainly wouldn't apply to him.
Right. All right, Ryan, anything else?
I guess my final question would be, UFC had an event this weekend. What does that do to the ratings when, say, like NXT is running the show? Like, historically, has that proven to take away a large portion of their audience, or do they still do like normal ratings for the TV ratings?
Well, I think more of it has to do with who's fighting on the card and the quality of the card. But that being said, there definitely is a crossover in fan bases. So when you have a good product such as NXT running up against it, I would say it would definitely pull some UFC fans away from especially this past card, because it wasn't one of their better cards. I can see it definitely taking a hit in the ratings, but I would say it would probably be more because of the quality of the card than because of the competition they're going up against. Not to say that, you know, they wouldn't suffer a little bit of a dip, but I don't think it's that alarming where they're going to, you know, change anything up. Zach, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, no, I think it's the same thing. I think it's entirely dependent on both cards, really, but mainly the UFC card for that night. I think if it has star power and a reason to watch that's better than what we saw this past weekend, then I think it does better up against an NXT TakeOver show. If the reverse happens and the power isn't there, then I think it certainly affects the rating, no doubt.
Yeah, and I mean, just take for me, for and as an example, having the WWE Network, I know I can always go back and watch it on demand, so I don't have to watch it live, where I think you're more prone to watch a UFC card live than you are actually going back and DVRing it. Robert, would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely, because you're not inundated with, you know, SportsCenter updates and stuff like that for an NXT card necessarily, so you can avoid it without being spoiled. It would be interesting to go deep, to dive into that, to see if maybe there is any correlation, but I'll say this, though. Even when there is a head-to-head competition with a TakeOver and a Fight Night card, you're still usually afforded the time to see the main bouts on a Fight Night card, in particularly, as we've been joking, this card this last week drug on so long that you wouldn't have missed that much of the actual card if you would have watched live TakeOver in its entirety.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Because
I think I want to say TakeOver wrapped up at about 9:30, so, or Central Time. So there was certainly plenty of time to kick back and catch the fight afterwards.
Yeah, for sure. Ryan, anything else?
That's it. Thanks for taking my call.
All right, thanks for calling. All right, guys, let's take our first commercial break, and when we come back, we do have another caller on hold, and then we will jump into the latest MMA News Notebook.
Support what we do here at the PW Torch Livecast when you shop Amazon. Simply go to pwtorch.com/Amazon. We've simplified the page. There's a big Amazon logo. You click on it. It takes you right to Amazon's homepage. But because of that small detour, we get credit for your visit, and we get a commission on anything you buy on that shopping trip. That's pwtorch.com/Amazon. Thank you very much for your support.
Hello, is this a Skype caller? If you can hear me, you are on.
Yeah, it's your Russian caller again.
Yeah, I didn't. What's the first name again?
Valentin.
Valentin. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, right.
Okay. All right. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
If battery chargers will stop Volkan Ozdemir from fighting for UFC light heavyweight title, will Alexander Gustafsson be UFC's only choice for the title fight?
Yeah, I'm curious to see how this plays out. Considering it's kind of recent, a recent development, I don't think all the facts are in just yet as to how severe the allegations are of this, but I would assume if he is out of the fight with Cormier, it would make sense for them to give it to Gustafsson. Robert or Zach, I don't know if you guys have a little bit more information, but as far as I know, all the information wasn't in yet to actually make, you know, come to a logical conclusion with which direction it's going to go.
No, but it seems to make the decision a lot easier for the UFC, though, if they have to go that, you know, just to put Gustafsson in there. Gustafsson probably has the right of way anyway, so this maybe just reinforces that if push really comes to shove.
Yeah, I thought he should have gotten the fight to begin with. That's the fight I think most people wanted. So if this is the fight that they get, I think I don't think it's going to make many fans unhappy that this happened, considering this is actually the fight that people probably wanted to see most. Zach, anything to add to that?
No. Yeah, that was my choice, the fight that I wanted to see also. So UFC could be in a position where they're looking at it and going, okay, maybe this, you know, this worked out for the best.
Yeah, for sure. Valentin, anything else?
If Holly Holm versus Chris Cyborg is a big enough main event for UFC 219, or is there still a chance they will book some other main event like Tyron Woodley versus Nate Diaz on there?
No, I think that's going to be the main event. I think it's a solid main event. I do think they would be wise to have a solid co-main event on that card, but in my personal opinion, I think that's a perfectly fine main event, Holm versus Cyborg. Zach, what do you think?
I think it's a perfectly fine main event too, and I think at this point in time, it's barring anything, you know, crazy happening like a Woodley and Diaz fighting, I think it will be the main event. But to your point, though, I think they do need to supplement it with a good co-main event of some kind. If for some reason they can get Woodley and Diaz onto the card, I think you're working with a kind of a double main event situation, which is good. But until that happens, or until that gets inked, I think Holm and Cyborg is a fight people have been waiting for. I think it's a fight people want to see, and I think it's a fight people will pay to see. So to the main event it goes.
Yeah, for sure. Robert, anything to add?
Well, look, Holm Cyborg in any other context is a perfectly fine pay-per-view main event, but I think part of the problem that the UFC is running into now is they want to bring these major cards, these sort of tentpole cards, have so many title fights on them that they're pulling title fights everywhere, and that's kind of the only way they seem to be able to draw big numbers anymore. So I could see them really trying to stretch really hard to book something. With that said, outside of Woodley, there's not a lot of championship bouts to book. So I don't know if they're going to – I think they're going to want to book another title fight or possibly even double title fights on there. But I just don't think it gets done.
Well, yeah, I mean, you had three title fights on UFC 217, so that's definitely going to leave a bit of a gap in the amount of fights, or at least title fights you can make on the next couple cards coming up. So, Valentin, do you have any other questions for us?
And how big is this fight, Nate Diaz versus Tyron Woodley? Because I like Nate Diaz, but he's obviously not a welterweight contender, so it just looks kind of weird for me.
Well, I think Woodley is smart in trying to get Nate Diaz to take the fight. It's probably Woodley's bigger, I guess, money fight, so to speak. So I understand why he's angling for that fight. I don't think... And I can't speak to this definitively, but from what I understand is Nate Diaz is asking for a pretty large payday. So I think, especially with Woodley being his opponent, I don't think that is a fight that the UFC is too keen on making, especially with what Nate Diaz is asking for as far as money. Robert, do you agree with that, or do you have any a different assessment of the situation?
Yeah, that's pretty much how I see it. I think Nate Diaz is in that position that some people are when they're negotiating more, you know, make me an offer that I literally can't refuse or else I'm not getting out of bed. And that seems to be where he's at. I don't think this fight would be that huge of a fight, to be honest with you.
I don't either.
By some measurements, Nate Diaz is a huge draw, but we haven't really tested that drawing power divorced from Conor McGregor.
Right.
Like, did he get the rub from the McGregor fights? Obviously, he's a much bigger star than before the McGregor fights, but can he on his own sell that? And against a guy like Woodley, who I think the public might be a little soured on because he's had sort of underwhelming fights on very big cards. So even though he's a really good fighter, I think the casual Joe Blow audience might see him on a fight card and not be too keen to purchase it.
Yeah, I agree with all that. Zach, anything to add?
Yeah, I agree as well. I'm not convinced that this fight gets signed either, but that doesn't change my opinion of the fact that I think Woodley is really, really smart in angling for it. I think he hears and sees kind of the flack that he took for his most recent fights, and for as good of a fighter as he is kind of publicly perceived as a boring fighter that doesn't deliver, you know, in big cards, in big spots. And I think by linking himself to Nate Diaz, who is, you know, essentially the polar opposite. He's an exciting guy. He talks a lot. You know, he's got a good attitude. He's got a, you know, strong, passionate fan base. By linking up to him, you know, he can play off that a little bit and get the rub from Diaz. But like Robert said, though, you know, the proof really isn't in the pudding on Diaz yet as a big draw on his own. So he's commanding the dollars that he is, but you know, he hasn't really proved that yet as a standalone attraction. So it's interesting to see where they go here, but I just think it was a, you know, smart, you know, PR effort on Woodley's part to angle for this fight.
Yeah, for sure, I agree. All right, Valentin, I know it's early in the morning where you're calling from. Anything else for us?
No, that is it. I appreciate you taking my call.
Yeah, I appreciate you calling. Please do call again.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot. All right, guys. Let's move into the MMA News Notebook. So we have early estimates for UFC 217, the North American pay-per-view buys. Zach, if I told you going into the event that it would do more than 750,000 buys, would you have agreed with that statement?
I would have agreed with that statement, yes. I think between three championship fights and the return of George St. Pierre, the fight and the event happening at Madison Square Garden in New York, I think three title fights sells itself. I think the undercard was pretty good. And then you get the returning legend factor. And I think, yes, I would have, if it was a fact or fiction question, I would have said fact.
Right. Yeah. The actual number is estimated to be around 875,000 buys, actually making it the highest drawing card of the year. Robert, does that information surprise you?
A little bit, because I didn't feel there was a ton of buzz about it in the week going in. So I actually predicted it to be in the range of the sixes or so. I think the 800,000 range is actually the new million, so to speak, in that I don't think they, outside of, you know, digging up Conor McGregor, Ronda Rousey, Brock Lesnar, I don't think they have a million pay-per-view buys on that roster, no matter how much they stack a card. So just like UFC 214, I think the 800,000 is like the new benchmark for, you know, a super, super successful card.
Yeah, if I'm the UFC, I think I would be pretty happy with that number. And it's just surprising hearing that that's the highest drawing card of the year when, you know, in past years, I mean, yeah, you've had Conor McGregor fighting a lot more. So there's a lot more opportunity to get over that million pay-per-view buy mark. but yeah, if I was the UFC, like I said, I think I would be pretty happy with that number. I'd be curious to see what the exact numbers are once those come in. So moving on, Chris.
I was just going to say too. I think from the UFC standpoint, it might interesting, and I wondered if they're looking at, like, okay, you know, what was the draw, the main draw here? Was there a main draw? Like, was it St. Peter that you know, drove it to be the highest, you know, the biggest watched pay-per-view of the year? Was it the three title fights? Because that could be something that they go back to and they say, okay, you know, like you alluded to earlier when talking about the Cyborg home card, that, you know, are people more interested in a card loaded with title fights, or are they more interested in someone like St. Pierre returning? I think it's something that UFC might look at here in terms of how they may structure and book fights in 2018.
Yeah, that's a good point. In my opinion, I think there was more interest in the return of GSP than the three title fights, because when you look at the women's title fight, neither one of the women were big draws coming in. And while Dillashaw and Garbrandt both have names and are, you know, pretty highly recognized fighters, if that was a standalone main event, I don't think it would have done well as far as pay-per-view buys goes. So I personally think it was more the return of GSP. Robert, agree or disagree?
I'm in complete agreement with you. Those other two title fights had a lot of buzz by people who would have bought the card regardless. So I think they were just a little bit of icing on the cake. I think GSP once again has proved that he is a massive pay-per-view star, specifically how he gets the Canadian audience and the Canadian market involved in the UFC like nobody else really does. So I think the star power of GSP, I think you could have had a pretty mundane undercard and still got very good results out of that whole situation.
Yeah, I'm in agreement there. So, and speaking of Chris Cyborg, she made news by signing a new deal with the UFC. The deal is rumored to be for 15 months and makes her the highest paid female fighter on the roster and actually one of the top paid fighters in the organization overall. Zach, if these rumors are true, does the Cyborg signing make sense given the current state of the women's featherweight division?
I think it does make sense. Yes. I think to me, 2017 has been the year of UFC trying to find draws to begin with. And I think that especially holds true for the women's divisions, with, you know, Ronda Rousey exiting the sport seemingly, they need, you know, people to build on and to draw money. On top of that, I think, and Cyborg, you know, she crosses off and puts check marks next to all those things. So I think it makes a ton of sense to have her in that position. And I think there's some exciting matchups, starting with the home one, for her to have within the entirety of that contract.
Yeah, Robert, what are your thoughts on that signing if the numbers are true?
It's in the long run, I think it's the best thing for certainly for the UFC and probably for both parties. Cyborg's one of the few big draws that the UFC has that they actually would be worried about losing her to another organization, because she would probably remain active as a fighter. Let's face it, you know, Ronda Rousey not being a UFC fighter hurts the UFC because they don't have her to promote, but it's not like she's appearing on Bellator cards and just destroying them from a form of competition. I think the same thing could be said for a guy like Conor McGregor. If Cyborg were to walk, I think every MMA company in the world would line up their Brinks truck to sign her, to bring her in, and she would be an active fighter and could actually, you know, detract from the UFC's business. It's interesting, though. Hopefully this contract, though, was beneficial enough to both sides that they can have a smoother relationship, because even when they are sane and doing all the right things, getting Chris Cyborg into the octagon seems like the most difficult task that the UFC has. So hopefully this smoothed over a lot of the issues that they previously have had.
Yeah, I'm in agreement there. And the reason why I kind of asked the question I did was because just looking at the featherweight division, I mean, yeah, you have Holly Holm and Jermaine Durandamy, who at this point I'm skeptical is even going to come back, let alone want to fight Cyborg. So I guess my worry is, with such a thin division, and calling it a division is probably a stretch at this point, considering where home goes after this. Are you guys a little concerned? And Zach, I'll start with you. Are you just a little concerned about the UFC being able to match opponents up with Cyborg after the home fight?
Yeah, I think that is something to to think about it. I haven't really thought about it in those terms, but the way you lay it out, yeah, because I don't know that there's anybody else that can even come close to the same level of talent that Cyborg has. I'm not even sure that Holm does at this point. So yeah, I think they will, you know, while she is a draw, her fights just could end up being, you know, nothing fights because she's just so dominant.
And maybe the UFC's okay with it. Maybe they just put her up, you know, kind of like squash matches, you know, and maybe the UFC's happy to have that. And maybe there's a big enough, you know, appetite that, you know, they're going to be able to sell pay-per-view buys off of it. That remains to be seen. But, yeah, my concern is just the quality of fights that she's going to have in the UFC. Robert, anything to add?
I agree that the talent pool is very thin. We've talked about it a lot of times. There is no featherweight division. They have a featherweight championship. It's not a true division. And after the home fight, let's see if Megan Anderson eventually gets back into the fold. Past that, there's not a lot to do. But if the UFC can really turn Cyborg into a star, it's kind of like with the Diaz thing. You're going to find people that want to fight them, even if it's not necessarily a conventional fight. So I think you're going to have willing participants, whereas in the past, like, nobody wanted to fight Cyborg because, you know, they didn't want to get their face smashed in. I think fighting Cyborg can have more incentive to it now than it did before.
Right. So the more zeros on the check, the more likely someone wants to get their face punched in by Cyborg.
I would assume.
Right.
Yep.
All right. Moving on. The UFC, they've been dealing with a string of bad behavior issues with its fighters lately. Fabricio Werdum has been involved in two out of the last three most recent incidents. First, he was involved in an altercation with Tony Ferguson. And then most recently, just last week, with Colby Covington. And then sandwiched in between that was Conor McGregor's altercation with referee Mark Goddard, and not to mention his homophobic slurs after the Artem Lobov fight. And then we just get word of Oldsmar's assault charge. And look, I get every business, whether it's big or small, is going to have employee behavior issues to deal with. I get that. But what I find more surprising is the UFC's silence and lack of discipline in all of it. Zach, you've written columns for MMAtorch.com in the past calling out the UFC for, you know, such actions. So I'll start with you. Give us your take on all this.
Yeah, I think, look, it's a situation that they have to watch and watch carefully. I think it's almost, you know, at this point, it's getting to be a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy for them, because they haven't said anything about anything in the past, like the McGregor slur, him jumping in the cage, the previous Verdun thing. You know, they've said some things, but there hasn't been any clear-cut, you know, action taken. I think more, you know, fighters, they don't fear any sort of repercussions. And it gets to the point where this is, you know, it's on the UFC. I mean, the UFC is a big company now, $4.2 billion, and they need to start acting like one in my eyes. And that means, you know, having their employees and their fighters and the guys that are, you know, representing the brand and representing the sport of MMA, respect it a little bit more. And for that reason, it starts with, you know, laying down the law, whether that's fines to some people or other punishment to guys where fines don't matter. I think at this point, they need to act swiftly, and they need to act quickly. It can't be a thing where they choose to act on, you know, punishments when it fits their business model, or whether it will or won't hurt a fight. It has to be consistent, and it has to be, you know, soon after these things, so that fighters don't think that they run the show. And at this point, I think it's going to be a hard thing for them to dial back, because they have kicked the can down the road so far. But at some point, they just got to say enough's enough and start disciplining these guys, because after all, it is their company. It is the brand. It is, you know, the sport of MMA should be more respected, and you don't want your guys out and about looking like thugs as they promote these cards.
Yeah, and especially knowing that the UFC's deal with Fox is coming up. So they're going to be looking for a big money contract with whoever their next TV deal is with. So you would think that they would want to have a pretty squeaky clean image, especially when it comes to, you know, possible partners going forward. Robert, what are your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, the UFC just needs to determine what it's going to be. And that's what this really comes down to. There's times when the UFC acts like they're these completely detached, objectionable promoter of independent contractors that doesn't get involved in anything. That's how they act when it comes to regulations and athletic commissions. And, you know, they stay out of all the drug testing stuff. They always, you know, try to take a hands-off approach. But at the same time, they're a company that hands out like these subjective performance bonuses and likes to what they pick and choose when they find outside opportunities for fighters to promote cards. So they need to determine what are they going to be. If they're going to sort of get in every other aspect of these fighters' lives, then they probably should at least speak out to distance themselves from some of these actions. Their silence seems very self-serving because their most profitable fighter has been involved in some of these things. Therefore, I think they don't want to be on the wrong side of him. So they can't really, you know, when Covington says something stupid, if Verdum throws a boomerang at him, they can't really do anything about it because they just had borderline criminal behavior by their most profitable fighter within the same week. So I think the UFC needs to really determine what they're going to be. And this all stems too from them. Like we said, they're part of corporate America now. Maybe they're not a publicly traded company, but they're definitely a much more visible company than they were even a year ago. So they need to determine, are they going to play ball with those people, or are they going to continue to be an outlaw, you know, renegade promotion, which is fine. The UFC was kind of built on that. But I don't think that's where they're really headed towards, especially with the TV deal. I mean, look, when you watch a UFC on Fox, if you notice, there are no Ford commercials on there, because even though Ford does a lot of sponsoring for FS1, they refuse to attach their product to MMA and to the UFC.
Right.
And stuff like this, while we know that, you know, there's a lot of good dudes in the UFC and a few knuckleheads, just like in every other sport, they still haven't scrubbed that reputation that they're not just a bunch of like angry white dudes committing crimes. They really need to scrub that reputation. They haven't done that, and these things don't help, and the UFC's indifference to them doesn't help to alleviate that perception either.
Yeah, Zach, anything to add?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really well said. And you know, ultimately, you know, it comes down to they're promoting fights here, and I think we all get that. You guys, you know, like Robert said, a lot of them are really great guys. Some of them are knuckleheads. A lot of them, maybe all of them, are characters. They all have that personality trait that allows them to get into the octagon and fight somebody who wants to knock them out. I mean, that's an interesting personality trait to explore and analyze, but they have to walk the fine line of being able to promote that so that it can draw money and be interesting, but also not cross the line into complete, you know, renegades running all over the country and kind of, you know, dragging UFC through the mud as they try to make their company bigger and grow their TV deal, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. All right, guys, let's take our second commercial here. And then when we come back, there is an email question I do want to get to. And then we will play another round of Fact or Fiction.
When you want to know when the next episode of the PW Torch Livecast is scheduled or catch up on a show you missed, check out our homepage, pwtorchlivecast.com. You can stream the latest shows right from that page, or download the show, or get a link to subscribe on a podcast app. That's pwtorchlivecast.com for the latest shows, and also catch up on shows you missed at pwtorchlivecast.com.
All right, guys, we do have an email I wanted to get to. This one comes from Tom Pfeiffer in Spokane, Washington. He asks, what do you guys make of Dana White saying the UFC wants to promote boxing? Can this lead to an added revenue stream since their pay-per-view numbers are down this year? First of all, I take everything Dana White says with a grain of salt. I'm not convinced in the slightest that they are getting into boxing anytime soon, if ever or at all. So, like, I'm skeptical that that's even going to happen. Robert, I'll go to you on this. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, back in August, I actually wrote a column for MMA Torch, you know, kind of outlining why I thought that it was generally a bad idea for them to get into boxing, and I still think it is. Can they make money doing boxing? Maybe. Would it be a good brand of boxing? Probably not.
Right.
The way that the UFC does business, boxers, why would any good boxer want to go through that process of being of having so much of your revenue in the control of a promoter? Additionally, I think there's the other element that people don't talk about. Like last week, there was a lot of hearings about the Ali Act and it expanding to MMA. Well, it's already relevant in boxing. So then this company that's fighting so hard against it in one respect, in one, you know, aspect of their business, would then have to reluctantly embrace it in another one. And that seems to really create some muddy waters. You know, a one-off isn't bad. Say Holm Cyborg, say if they wanted to do a second fight that was a boxing match and they did the things necessary to promote it, I don't think that would be the end of the world. But as far as a full-fledged you know, boxing promotion with rankings and all this, I don't think it's in anyone's best interest for the UFC to get involved in it.
Yeah, Zach, do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And I agree with what you said at first, too, which is I don't know that Dana White even really, really believes that or really, really wants that. To me, it kind of was a little bit, you know, back in August when McGregor fought Mayweather, you know, MMA and UFC was kind of on a, you know, opening itself up to some new audiences with the audience that fight brought in. I don't know if he was trying to, you know, make a play to entice them a little bit to get interested in the UFC product, but I just don't see it happening. I mean, like Robert said, could they do it? Sure. Might they make a little bit of money? Possibly. But ultimately, you know, as Robert alluded to, they're not going to get the top tier fighters. So their boxing would always be seen as second level compared to everything else. And I don't think that's a good way to grow the company. I think you spread yourself to send that way. I think they should just focus on what they do and what they do best. And that makes more sense.
Yeah, I agree with both of you on both your takes on that. All right, guys, let's move on to another round of fact or fiction. We'll start with GSP's next fight will be against Robert Whittaker. Zach, is that fact or fiction?
I'm going to say fact on that. I think the story writes itself. I think GSP fighting at middleweight looked to be very comfortable for him. I'm not sure he'd want to make the cut down to a different weight division. And so that's the money fight. Whitaker's the interim champion. GSP needs to fight him to shore up his place within that division. So I'm going fact there.
Robert.
I'm actually going to say fiction. I don't think he ever fights at middleweight again, to be honest with you. I think his next fight's against either a Tyron Woodley in a really like a welterweight super fight, or as we discussed, he may actually end up winning the McGregor sweepstakes at some point. So I don't think he ever fights Whittaker or any of the real middleweight killers anytime soon.
Yeah, I think it's fiction for the exact reasons you pointed out, Robert. And also, kind of like just reading between the lines from what he said in his post-fight interview, I think he took the fight against Bisping because he knew he was going to win the fight. I think he's smart enough to know he's going to struggle against a fighter like Robert Whittaker. So, yeah, I think he goes back down, and I don't think we see that fight, unfortunately. All right, next we have Chris Cyborg is the greatest women's MMA fighter of all time. Zach, is that fact or fiction?
Oh man, this is tough. This is tough because I have a hard time in my head defining, you know, greatest of all time. I think when you talk in with those words, a lot gets involved with it. That's not just, you know, fight skill. And for that reason alone, I'm going to say fiction, and I'm going to just point to Ronda Rousey in that. I think she changed the game. She led the charge. Her run was, you know, an amazing run. And I think to me, if I'm looking at it, I look at her as the game changer and as kind of the pioneer of women's MMA. So I'm going to say fiction because of Ronda Rousey. Right or wrong?
Robert, is that fact or fiction?
I'm going to say fact just because she has been peerless in her entire time outside of her first fight 12 years ago. Nobody's been able to really even challenge her, and I think that speaks for something. Now, you can cite level of competition, but I think if you're comparing head-to-head with Ronda Rousey until the last couple years, I think you could make the same argument that there wasn't the greatest of competition there. I think the only caveat you have to put of it is like, you know, we want to be consistent on the PED thing, and some people will discount an Anderson Silva or a John Jones and their place in history because of PED use. Does that also carry as Chris Cyborg? So I think there's a discussion to be had there. But ultimately, I would actually put the rubber stamp on Cyborg being the greatest female fighter of all time.
Yeah, Robert, you bring up a good point with the PED talk. I agree with you. I think it's fact as well. I mean, look at Jermaine Durandamy. She was willing to have surgery when she probably could have gotten around not having it, just not to not fight Chris Cyborg. I think there are more women who actually fear getting into the cage with this woman. So I definitely think it's fact. You know, PED talk aside, I think it's fact. Next one here, guys. The UFC's reliance on pay-per-view buys is an antiquated business model and isn't sustainable long-term. Robert, I'll start with you. Is that fact or fiction?
I believe it's fact, and that's not to keep plugging myself. That's another thing I wrote about recently on The Torch.
Yeah, and I think that,
we're just seeing in general.
I had that article in mind, actually, when I wrote that.
Yeah, we've seen it that, like, I think pay-per-view as a whole in our society is becoming an antiquated thing where we'll buy Mayweather McGregor, but we're not going to spend monthly going to pay $60 for these very lukewarm fights. It just makes no sense to do so when everything else is getting cheaper and everything else is getting more streamlined, where, you know, we can pay $10 for the entire history of music that was ever written. It kind of feels really redundant to pay $60 for a average pay-per-view.
Yeah, I'm in full agreement with that take. Zach, is that fact or fiction?
Yeah, I agree as well. That is fact. I think, you know, you can look to the WWE for that too. I mean, look, they're selling WrestleMania for $9.99 a month, and I think when the UFC is competing with something like that, it's hard to say that's a good business model that's sustainable. Like, I think one-offs here and there for the year, people will shell out some money for the big fights, but ultimately it's not something that people are going to say, okay, well, I'm going to carve off $60 a month so I can get the monthly UFC pay-per-view when, you know, WWE is giving away Survivor Series for $10. Just, it doesn't make sense, and I don't think it is sustainable long-term.
Yeah, and what got me thinking about it, too, was the fact Ring of Honor is coming out with their own streaming service. So even they're getting away from the whole pay-per-view business model.
Right.
And I think even Billy Corgan's NWA promotion, I think they specifically talked about not wanting to get into pay-per-view. So it's definitely an issue that the UFC is going to have to kind of tackle at some point. Maybe they currently are. I just wish that I just wish Fight Pass was a better product, and I know this is something else that Robert has written about as well. Just making Fight Pass worth people's time, and making it worth the UFC's time to put good cards on Fight Pass. I think you have to crawl before you can walk. I think the UFC needs to actually kind of bite the bullet and delve into this. And Robert, not to, you know, delve into the past archives of your media and business articles, but I know you talked about that as well. So if you don't mind, just kind of, you know, giving our listeners who haven't read it, just a kind of a brief overview of what you mentioned on that.
On the Fight Pass one?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and I just – that was one where I just gave, you know, basic suggestions of what other streaming companies, other media companies do. And I some things they've actually done, like – and I'm not going to take credit for it, but it just happened to be coincidence that it was done, such as like the alternate commentary and streamlined way to find fights and having one sort of cat miss fight a month on there. And my biggest argument always against Fight Pass is that, well, it's a good service to have, and it's nice, you know, maybe if you're writing a prediction column, it's nice to be able to go back and look at, you know, every Michael Bisping fight and kind of see where he's progressed in a very easy fashion. But outside of that, it's not really an essential product for a UFC fan to have. I mean, you know, often these prelims that are on Facebook, I mean, excuse me, not Facebook, what is this, 10 years ago, that are on Fight Pass, they're decent fights, but they're very missable fights. They're people that, you know, you can go a while and then maybe catch the buzz about them later. So I think it's what the problem with it, it's a very unessential piece of the viewing process. Whereas when you take a product like the WWE Network, unless you want to pay $60 a month for their pay-per-views, and sometimes they have two a month, you absolutely have to have the network in order to be a dedicated fan, where I think you could kind of skate by without Fight Pass.
Right, and I think that, you know, one of the big differences, too, between the WWE Network and Fight Pass is your MMA hardcores are going to have Fight Pass, where the WWE Network, you have a lot of casual fans who have the network. Yeah, they might not catch every Raw or SmackDown every week, but they have the network, and they're going to turn it on, you know, for, you know, maybe it is once a month just to catch, you know, the WWE Network specials, or, you know, maybe they want to go back and watch, you know, back in, you know, AWA, you know, wrestling matches or what have you. So I think that's one of the big differences, too, where the UFC has to figure out a way to get your casual fan to want to subscribe to Fight Pass. And I think that's one of the most difficult things that faces them right now. So, all right, guys, so let's move into a couple WWE statements here. And these are all pretty much based on Survivor Series, which we will touch on in our final segment. But let's start with AJ Styles is the best wrestler in the world. Robert, is that fact or fiction?
I am going to say that is fact. You can take your Kenny Omegas and I'll see you at AJ Styles any day of the week. No, and I just think it's the diversity of what he can do. I mean, not everybody could have that match that he had last night with Brock Lesnar, but somebody as talented as AJ Styles, who not only is a good athlete, I think it gets lost how good of a professional wrestler he truly is.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think that's fact as well. Zach, what are your thoughts?
Absolutely. Fact, 100%, no ifs, ands, or buts. And I thought of Kenny Omega, too. And here's the thing. It's just, you know, AJ Styles, he can do it against any opponent. He's had top matches with a variety of different styles on big-time levels. At WrestleMania with Shane McMahon, arguably the match of the night. And the thing is, I think more and more now that we've seen these, you know, these veteran guys who come in from the indie scene and they hit or from Japan and they hit NXT and then they get to that main roster and they're just not quite as over as people thought they'd be or as, you know, they were in a previous part of their career. AJ Styles isn't that guy. I mean, he's a guy who came in and has, you know, increased his value or at the very least kept it the same as it was since he got here. So I think he's kind of the outlier in that. And because of that, yeah, no question, he's the best in the world right now.
Definitely 100% agreement with both of you there. All right, John Cena has officially phoned in his WWE appearances. Zach, is that fact or fiction?
I would say it's fact for right now. I think in regards to last night, I think he absolutely phoned that in. And I don't know that he phoned it in because he was lazy or because he didn't, you know, want to put on a better show. But I think just with the movie commitments that he has right now and with what he has going on outside of WWE and outside of the wrestling ring, I think he just can't put himself in a position where he can get seriously injured. There's a lot of people and a lot of money behind him being healthy here, and I don't think he wants to mess that up for himself. So do I think he's phoning it in? Yes, but I don't think it's because he just is lazy and not interested in WWE anymore. I think it's simply because he can't put himself in harm's way, and that limits what he can do in the ring for the time being.
Yeah, I think he may have learned from The Rock getting injured when he was getting set to film Hercules.
Right, exactly. That's a perfect comparison. You just, you know, it's with what he has on the table right now, you know, and I don't blame him for not wanting to risk that. He's had a nice run, and, you know, I don't fault him at all for doing that. Now, that said, I don't think WWE needs to bring him back when he's not able to do anything, but that's a different question.
Right, okay. And Robert, is that fact or fiction?
Yeah, I'm going to say fact as well. I think that Bruce Mitchell, the Torch, referred to him in a column a couple months ago as, like, over it, Cena. That's the point he's at. And I think that's definitely the case where if it's not something worthwhile, he's not going to put everything into it. He put a ton into his feud with Roman Reigns. He definitely brought it, you know, say what you want about maybe not liking the match or the aesthetics of those promos, but he was definitely invested in that. I think that they have him coming back for something mid-card like a Baron Corbin or a – sort of weird thing where he's on Team SmackDown, even though he has been on Raw. If something doesn't really make sense to him, I think then he's really just there to move merchandise and sell a few pay-per-views and not really be full on invested in it.
All right, guys, let's take our final break. And then when we come back, we will review last night's WWE Survivor Series.
We know you're a pro wrestling fan, but you might like MMA too. And if so, check out our sister site, MMATorch.com, with live fight event coverage, including UFC pay-per-views, previews of all UFC and Bellator events, the daily news digest, exclusive columns, flashbacks, and much more. Check it out. If you're a fan of MMA, you'll be a fan of MMATorch.com.
All right, guys, let's finish up with our thoughts on last night's WWE Survivor Series. We'll start with the main event and then work backwards. So in the main event, it was Team Raw defeating Team SmackDown in the Men's Survivor Series match. It was Triple H giving Shane McMahon a pedigree to get the win for his team. Zach, I'll start with you on this. I'm going to save my comments just because of my bias towards Triple H and the oxygen-sucking qualities of all his matches. But what did you think of the match? And then, I guess, more specifically, what were your thoughts on the finish?
Yeah, I thought my Triple H sentiments are going to shine through here, too. But I thought, you know, for me, it was a little bit of a disappointing match, to be completely honest with you. And, you know, this is not just hating on Triple H, but I think it was disappointing a lot because of his involvement in certain places. You know, they were just beating us over the head with the fact that, you know, it's Triple H in the ring. This is Triple H's show. He's in the match. He's the biggest star. You know, they even said so I think the announcers once or twice even alluded to it was Triple H who brought Shinsuke Nakamura over. It was just so Triple H focused that I think it took away from the rest of the match. I think from the audience standpoint, when I look at the match itself, the biggest reactions came from when the new guys or the current crop of guys were doing cool stuff in the ring. When Shinsuke Nakamura went one-on-one with Finn Balor, when Samoa Joe was involved, Braun Strowman, obviously. And I think that Triple H being in there, he sucks the attention because he is Triple H, and I think it's wearing thin for me, definitely. And based on the crowd reactions last night, I feel like it's wearing thin on them too. The finish, just it was confusing. It didn't make any sense, and doesn't matter what they say on Raw tonight or what Triple H said. I think there's a better way to get to where they needed to go yesterday than Triple H helping pin one of his own teammates and then getting the pinfall on the deciding pinfall on the SmackDown Live side too. So to me, it just was hard to piece together why they did it that way and where it was going to go. And I just don't think it flowed. Shane McMahon being the last guy, also, it gave away the ending of the match. I mean, throughout the whole thing, the buildup is who's going to win, who's better, Raw or SmackDown. And then when you have Shane McMahon sitting there 3-on-1 and 10 minutes left of the match, it's like, okay, well, obviously he's going to lose. And so there's no excitement left. And I think Wade and the guys talked to him about it on the VIP post show, that same thing. And it rang true for me, too. So I was just disappointed in the whole thing. I thought there was too much talent in there for it to go the way that it did, and not enough moments between the guys to make it shine like it should have. And that a screwy finish, and it didn't click for me.
And Robert, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, as far as the match goes itself, I thought the match was very mundane, kind of like a house show match where it was just guys, you know, hitting moves here or there, a guy gets eliminated, you know, whatever. I think the intentions actually were pure in this sense that it was – because the end result was the newer guy that fans have been clamoring for like 6 months getting, you know, toppling Triple H. People have kind of lost – I think the animus to Triple H is so huge in general that people actually lost sight of what happens. But there is also the counter argument, which, like you guys are saying, that Triple H is such an oxygen sucker. And this happens a lot in his feuds where, yes, you know, he does actually put a lot of guys over, but even in the Seth Rollins feud, because everything is so catered to him and his way of doing things, that he ends up looking like the cooler guy in every scenario. So like he looked like the smartest guy in the world last night until Braun laid him out. So I think the intention was good. I just think the execution and the circumstances didn't lend itself to what they were quite going for. Mike?
Yeah, he had you on mute again. All right, sorry, guys. in the main event, or in the co-main event, Brock Lesnar pinned AJ Styles clean after an F5 in probably the best match of the night, in my opinion. Personally, I thought this match should have gone on last. Robert, I'll start with you. Were you surprised by the finish, and what did you think of the match overall?
I wasn't necessarily surprised by the finish because I think we all picked Brock to win last week, but I just thought this was a great match. Like I was singing AJ's praise earlier, but I mean, I think enough credit has to go to Brock, and it's amazing how when you think about Brock, he works so much better with these type of guys. Whereas when you see him going up against Braun Strowman, they almost kind of cancel each other out. But when you see him go even against a guy like Roman Reigns, who's much more pliable, or how he did here against AJ or his past with Kurt Angle, that he really plays his role well and played ball. And I was, you know, concerned that maybe this would be that kind of squash match, or it would be like an Ambrose situation where it was very uninspired. No, Lesnar definitely gave it his all, and we know how good AJ is. And I like I said last week, I don't think AJ is in any way hurt by this loss. I think they told a good enough story that AJ does not look weak. He looks like he's a guy that got caught by an F5 from the toughest guy in the promotion.
Yeah, and can Brock Lesnar make it any more obvious when he's motivated and when he's not in matches? I mean, it's like
he should just like wear a shirt that indicates if he's motivated or not. Right. We know when to watch.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Zach, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought this was, you know, no pun intended here, but a phenomenal, phenomenal match. I think both guys, you know, looked great going in, and I think they looked equally as good, if not better, coming out. I'm not surprised that the match was good. I was expecting it to be really good, and it was really good. What surprised me was just how much Lesnar gave to AJ in the terms of selling. I mean, I think he really put over the calf crusher in particular, and some of those, you know, phenomenal forearms. I mean, he just sold for AJ like a million bucks, and it made AJ look really, really good and dangerous, and as a viable opponent to Brock Lesnar. Finish didn't surprise me. I figured Lesnar was going to go over, but I think, yeah, like Robert said, the story that they told puts AJ on a different level now, and I think, you know, after this match, it's clear he is one of the most popular, if not the biggest star that the WWE has right now. So props to both guys. I love the match.
Yeah, 100% agree with both of you guys on that match. All right, next we had Charlotte beating Alexa Bliss via tap out in 15 minutes in a match I just thought was good. Not great, definitely was predictable. Zach, I'll start with you. What was your take?
Yeah, I actually really, really enjoyed this match. I thought Alexa Bliss, I think she looked, you know, on par with Charlotte, which I thought was going to be a hard thing to accomplish going into it. I thought, you know, Charlotte, first of all, her physical appearance is dominating, especially over Alexa Bliss, who's so tiny. But I thought she really played the role well, and I thought she hung better than I anticipated. That said, I, you know, it wasn't a great match. I don't think it's going to be one that either is going to be remembered by, but I think they have something to build off of here. I think, you know, look, this match was put together with virtually, you know, no promos, no hype, no storyline development, show to show. And I think if they ever fight each other on the same brand again, I think if you add that promo element to the match, I think it could be better with a better story. So I liked it, but it's you know, kind of going to fall by the wayside in terms of the event as a whole.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with that. Robert, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, pretty agnostic on the match. It was a good match. It just nothing really stood out. But I think there's something definitely in the future that could be built. I think it's another example, too, of in pro wrestling, as good as, you know, people doing moves are, you do need a little bit of a story. And there was virtually no story leading up to this match. So I think that took a little bit away from that. But, you know, neither was really harmed. It's kind of like the Brock and AJ win. It'd be almost unbelievable for such a smaller person to beat the bigger dominant champion. So I had no issue with how any of this played out.
All right, guys, moving on to the tag team match. We had the Usos defeating Sheamus and Cesaro in 16 minutes. I believe it was Sheamus taking the pin. Robert, I'll start with you on this one.
A very good match. I think, again, these are four of like the eight guys that have been kind of the low-key MVPs of WWE pay-per-views this year, and they delivered again. It wasn't on the level of the Usos New Day's match or the Sheamus Cesaro versus the Shield guys, but I still thought this was a very good match. You know, considering where it was in the card and stuff, it's a match that another one that I wouldn't hate seeing again. I'm really excited still for the tag team divisions because I just think that it's something that WWE was so lackluster on for so many years, and now they finally have such a good crop of true tag teams.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. Zach, what was your take?
Yeah, I agree too. Awesome match. And, yeah, these guys, Sheamus, Cesaro, and the Usos, I mean, you know, if you look at the brand-specific pay-per-views that we've had this year, like, those four guys are in the running of, you know, match of the night on almost all the cards. So seeing them together, I thought was really cool. I thought they put on a good match. I think the right team went over with the Usos winning. I think they're kind of the hotter commodity right now on SmackDown and the hotter tag team that still has some legs and still has higher places to go. But I certainly would like to see, I mean, if it ever happens, a prolonged feud between these guys would be welcomed, in my opinion. So I thought it was really good.
Next, Baron Corbin beat The Miz with an end of days out of nowhere in 10 minutes. I thought the right guy won here. Corbin definitely needed to win much more than The Miz, who basically can get his heat back with just one promo. Zach, do you agree with the booking in this one?
Yeah, I mean, I predicted last week that the Miz would win. Just to make a prediction, I could certainly have seen it going both ways. And going into it, had it been booked, The Miz winning, I think Corbin is a strong enough heel that he could have been settled with this loss as well. But Corbin going over certainly makes sense. It certainly positions him as a guy to be reckoned with on SmackDown. I thought the match itself was a little bit, for me, it was a little bit hard to watch and be fully invested in just because it's been so conditioned by their work on Raw and SmackDown respectively to hate both these guys. So it was, you know, hard to be in a position to like care enough to cheer one over the other. So that made the story and the match a little bit hard to click for me, but the outcome for Baron Corbin, I think it's a big win, a signature win. And I love this promo at the end. I thought that was a nice touch and kind of a cherry on top of the work that he did in the match.
Yeah, I really liked the promo at the end there. Robert, what were your thoughts on this match?
The match was okay. I just thought, similar to what, to piggyback off of what Zach said, there was just no heat to it because these are the two guys on each brand that do nothing to elicit any sort of cheers or empathy from the audience. And that's to their credit that they play these very irredeemable people that it's kind of hard to really get into the match itself. So it kind of just was what it was. I kind of felt this match very much was filler. I picked The Miz last week, but again, like you said, he can get – probably we're at, you know, 18 minutes into Raw. He probably has his heat back already.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. And the second match on the card was the Women's Survivor Series match where Team Raw defeated Team SmackDown. It was Asuka who got the win for her team. Robert, were you happy with the way Asuka was used in this match? And also give us your thoughts on the match overall.
Well, it's hard to complain about the way someone's used whenever they got the victory and got the last two falls so decisively. But I think our expectations for what we all want Asuka to be are so high that I think everybody wanted it to be like 1-on-5 and Asuka just to blaze through everybody. So that wasn't going to happen. This match was a little weird. I know I've been seeing a lot of complaints like there's so much Tamina. But I think you want to, there's stuff you want to save and stuff you don't want to get down to. Becky Lynch got eliminated immediately. So I think you still have the freshness, though, of Lynch and Asuka later on. The match was just – it was just kind of weird and kind of clunky, and there was that really weird blown spot with Naomi and Alicia Fox. But in the end, you had Asuka reigning supreme as sort of, you know, the queen of WWE still. So I wasn't too disappointed with what happened. It's just the problem, I think, with all these elimination matches is that people have to get eliminated. You know, it's not like a regular match where one person wins and one person loses, or you can have a screwy finish. People have to get eliminated in these matches, and that's always going to be the downside of doing it, is people are going to take pinfalls while taking less damage than they do in regular matches for some odd reason.
Yeah, I this was probably the least enjoyable match for me. Zach, what were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think Robert summed it up really well. I think ultimately, you know, in terms of storylines and who the company is behind right now, I think the match did its job overall in terms of positioning Asuka as, you know, the dominant women's wrestler in the WWE on both brands for the most part. So I think she looked just about as good as she could given the situation she was in with it being an elimination match. Like having her in the match and knowing what the WWE wants to do with her, it spoiled the outcome. Like you knew that she wasn't going to be taking a pinfall in a Survivor Series match like this. They're not going to waste that then. So going into it, it's hard to be fully invested because you already know the outcome. I'm just glad that, that Asuka looked strong as she did. Could she have looked stronger? Sure. But ultimately, I think the match did its job, which was get Asuka over more.
And in the opener, the New Day and the Shield set the bar extremely high with an excellent match that the Shield won in 21 minutes. I thought both teams came away looking like $1 million in this one, especially in a match where I think everyone knew what the finish was going to be and who was going to come out on top. Zach, where do you think they go from here with the Shield?
That's a really, really good question. And something that I was thinking about last night, because, you know, you look at the scene on Raw and it's like, okay, they've already done the thing with The Miz and Sheamus and Cesaro. And, you know, after that, even, I don't think there was that much, even without the New Day, I don't think there was a lot of a direction for the Shield to go. So it's a tough question to answer. I'd almost say that they might go back to some sort of incarnation with the Miz and Sheamus and Cesaro, just because there's nowhere else to go for them. This is one of my criticisms for bringing the Shield back right now, is because they didn't really have anybody lined up to face them, and that's a problem. So I think it's back to Miz and Sheamus and Cesaro, maybe, you know, something around the tag team titles, but outside of that, I think they're going to have some trouble in terms of where they go. Ultimately, you know, Roman Reigns is going his own way in a singles push. I mean, we all
right.
agree to that. We see the writing on the wall there. So it's almost as if, you know, the Shield exists right now to get Roman Reigns, you know, over as that babyface like Vince wants. But, you know, they got to have some good opponents to go up against for that to happen. So, yeah, it's a good question. I'm going to say Miz, Sheamus, and Cesaro, but tough call.
Yeah, Robert, same question to you.
Yeah, that's really difficult to sort of handicap where they're going to go. But I think despite all the oxygen sucking that Triple H did in the main event, there were other wrestlers in that match on Raw's side. So there are other main event pieces that you could kind of fit in against the Shield, whether that be something where they get in the middle of the Ballard Joe feud, or they start feuding with the Authority, or they start getting involved in with Kurt Angle because they are, you know, the Hounds of Justice and they have history with him. So I don't know. I don't have a direct answer, but I think you can shoot them to the top of the card. There is no reason to split these guys up. Roman Reigns is like this beloved conquering hero. I know he got some booze last night with the pay-per-view crowd, but on the general Raw audience, they're like, okay, you're going to have the match against Lesnar. Find two lackeys for Lesnar and just bring the Shield out with him at WrestleMania, because Roman Reigns is a completely different person in people's eyes when he's next to Seth or Dean. So keep the Shield together if you know what's good for you, WWE.
Yeah, I agree.
That's the weirdest thing. It's the weirdest thing.
Yep, I am in agreement. All right, guys, that'll do it. Good episode. Robert, go ahead and give our listeners some information on how they can follow you and if there's anything else you want to plug.
Sure. You could follow me on Twitter at Rob M. Vallejos, RobMVallejos. My column well has been a little dry lately, but as we discussed several times on the show, there is a back catalog of media business columns to look at. So, and most of them are actually very relevant right now with all the ongoings with TV negotiations and such. So just go through the back catalog and check those out. There's probably something that you'll be interested in.
And Zach, go ahead and let our listeners know how they can follow you.
Yeah, follow me on Twitter at zhedorn. That's at zhedorn. And check out the weekly column at MMATorch.com. Drops usually Thursday at some point. And you can also check out my PW Torch coverage of 205 Live every week at PWTorch.com.
And you can follow me on Twitter at FightChampBlog. And you can catch all my columns, as always, at MMATorch.com. And you can follow the brand at MMATorch as well. So for Zach and Robert, my name is Mike Brocky, and we will be back next week for another episode of MMA Talk for Pro Wrestling Fans.
PW Torch Livecast listeners, I invite you to get even more of what the Torch offers by becoming a PW Torch VIP member. Not only do you get ad-free access to our website, the mobile site, and the desktop site, and access to about 30 years of our archives, including over 1,500 back issues and thousands upon thousands of hours of our audio shows going back to 2004, plus tons of retro radio shows from the 1990s. But you also get over 15 VIP exclusive podcasts per week, in addition to ad-free editions of these PW Torch livecasts throughout the week. So we take the ads out of the PW Torch livecast for VIP members and then give you over 15 other podcasts per week, including what started it all, the Bruce Mitchell audio show. I host that with Bruce every weekend, and we spend a couple hours talking about the biggest stories of professional wrestling and wrestling history. It's one of the longest running weekly pro wrestling podcasts on any subject. And it's one of the main reasons people go VIP and stay VIP. Another is The Fix with Todd Martin. I host that every midweek with Todd, and we get Todd's expertise and opinions every midweek on current events in professional wrestling, not just WWE, but all promotions worldwide, including New Japan. Plus, we end every show with some expert MMA talk from the LA Times columnist and SureDog contributor, Todd Martin. And there's so much more. The Every Single Day Weight Killer Hotline with news updates every single day, Monday through Friday. And every Saturday and Sunday, I do the SE Editor format of the Weight Killer Hotline, where I answer VIP member questions in depth. And there's so much more. There's the Wayback Playback with Pat McNeil and Jim Valley, Wrestling Audio Community with Sean Radican, the WWE Future Pass Show with scouting reports on prospects and a look back at the indie career of current stars, the PW Torch East Coast Cast Extended VIP Edition, the retro radio shows. Every Thursday, a new retro radio show from the 90s drops, from the early 90s or the Attitude Era. And last but not least, my in-depth Raw and SmackDown reports. You can get a full chronological rundown of every episode of Raw and SmackDown with my analysis of the show in-depth every Monday night and Tuesday night. So check out details at pwtorch.com/govip. We give you a lot here at the live cast, but there is so much more. The vast majority of our work is for our VIP members, and you can become one today. Go check out details on a subscription at pwtorch.com/govip. This is live.